أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.
السلام عليكم. Peace be unto you. Welcome to another episode of Islam in Focus. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we're continuing with our 17th program in our series dealing with the sources of Islam. We'll have today our fifth segment in the looking at the question of the Quran in modern sciences. We'll be looking in particular at water and the water cycle. I have joining me on the program as usual Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Before we get into today's program examining this question of water and the water cycle, could I have you just quickly summarize the main points that we touched on in our last program?
Sure. Well, in the previous program, it was indicated that not only does the Quran mention that the heavenly bodies are in constant process of rotation, but it uses the term like swims along, indicating that the motion is emanating from these bodies or emanate from these bodies themselves. The other aspect that was discussed was the question of the succession of the day and night, and how the Quran says that Allah or God coils the day upon the night and coils the night upon the day, which indicates not only that the earth is spheric, but it indicates also the constant motion or rotation of the earth. It was also noted that the Quran makes an explicit reference to the rotation of earth, something that wasn't known at the time of the Prophet, when the Quran mentioned that the mountains moves as you see the clouds move, even though you think that they are stationary, which indicate again that as the clouds are moved by the wind, it's not self-emanating motion. So the mountains do not move themselves, but they move because the earth actually is also rotating. We discussed briefly also the expression of the sun and moon in the Quran, that it's not just mentioned as a major light or lesser light, but the term used for the sun, siraj, means source of light, whereas the moon simply says light, which could be a reflection from the light coming from the sun. We indicated that all of this information were not known in the 7th century to Prophet Muhammad. It wasn't the standard knowledge available. And the question here, where did it come from? Unless it is actually a revelation. The last question that was briefly discussed, we didn't complete its discussion, in fact, was the notion that the Quran indicates that there may be other earths, whether there may be other lives and or forms of life on other planets. And we indicated that, for example, in the first surah in the Quran, it uses the word worlds in plural. In surah 65, in passage 12, for example, it says that God also created several earths. But whether that indicates that there is a possible life on other planets or not, that's a different question. It doesn't say it one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to pick up on the last point and return to it. I think it would be of great interest to many of the viewers of the program, this whole question of the existence of life outside of
Star Earth. Wars and all that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you explain the Quranic position on that perhaps a little further?
Well, before I do that, one first has to distinguish between scientific fact and theory. Of course, one cannot say factually that there is or there isn't absolutely any other life outside of the earth, let's say, or similar condition. But what is generally accepted by scientists now is that at least for our solar system, there doesn't seem to be any indication that there could be life on any other planet that is within that solar system. Mm-hmm. That seems to be reasonably established. Of course, when the moon, you know, was explored, it was found that there could be no life on it. However, our solar system, as many scientists say, is not the only system. In our galaxy, the Milky Way, it is estimated that half of its stars, nearly 5 billion stars, are also rotating very slowly, a matter which indicates to many scientists that this shows that there are other satellite planets which are rotating also around those stars, the same way that our planets like Earth and Moon are rotating around the Sun. Now, the other systems, if you will, beyond our solar system, nobody can say for sure. I mean, we have not developed the capability yet to find out for sure whether there's some other Earths similar to ours or not. But in any case, the point is that the Quran seems to leave it open. It simply says that there are also other Earths in plural, without necessarily saying that they are exactly like our Earth, whether or not there could be life on this Earth or other planets. It's a matter which is open. There's no definite statement one way or the other on it.
Well, turning now to the question of water, is there any hint in the Quran about its role in sustaining life on Earth?
Yes, actually, there's very strong and clear references in the Quran about water. That's quite interesting because, of course, as you know, it was relatively recently that science discovered more and more about the significance of water in sustaining life. But one of the most fascinating passages in the Quran appears in Surah 21, that's 21:30, where it says, وَجَعَلْنَا مِنَ الْمَاءِ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ حَيٍّ. That is, God says, we made every living thing of, or it could also read, out of water. Now, the Quranic expression or the term ma' could mean two things. It has both etymological meanings. One is that it is just a fluid, like a sperm, for example. There are other citations in the Quran, like in Surah 77 and 24, where it actually refers to a sperm. That is, every living thing comes out as a result of this process of fertilization. But the other meaning also is simply water. Ma means also water. Which shows again that life is very much dependent, that any living thing is heavily dependent on water. And now what scientists are telling us is that approximately 70% of our weight is water. So if somebody, for example, weighs 70 kilograms, 50 of which are just water. And of course, in biology, it's known that the protoplasm, which is the main component, you know, of the human cell or animal cell, if you will, living cells, is actually composed of water. It's mainly dependent on water, without which, of course, a person cannot survive. We are told that you could live without food up to 60 days, but without water, that's a different story, between 3 to 10 days, and that's it. You get into a state of dehydration, and then you can't survive any longer. Well, of course, one can say that this information doesn't sound too strange or striking when we sit here in the 20th century and speak about it. But this is far remote from the various kinds of myths and strange ideas that existed at the time when these passages of the Quran were revealed in the 7th century. Not only this, the Quran speaks even beyond the importance of water, which is a more general type of statement. It speaks also even about something that was known comparatively recently, that is the nature of the water cycle.
Well, now, when we speak of the term water cycle, what is it? Can you explain what is meant by the term?
That's from the scientific standpoint.
Yes.
Well, basically, the scientists tell us, and this is something that has already been proven, and it's not a theory, really.
Yes.
That 70%, approximately, or 72% of the surface of the Earth is covered with water. Now, this is an essential point, because think of it. The sun is there. the rays of the sun is causing evaporation of these waters. Now, you might say that evaporation is not that much. But if there was not that delicate balance in the water cycle, and since the earth is, let's say, over 5 billion years old, and if the evaporation just continued like that over hundreds of millions of years, at one point of time, the entire water would have
evaporated,
and there would be no more water, unless there is, again, a cycle that returns this water back to the earth. Now, this vapor, then, of the water, as a result of the sun rays, ascends or rises into the atmosphere, and then through a process of condensation, we are told that clouds are formed. Now, at this point, the role of the winds become very essential and very crucial.
Yes.
Because for these clouds, the wind may either disperse it, disperse those clouds without any rain, or it may fragment it and produce rain in different stages of development, or it may combine. See, the wind keep pushing, combining those clouds with other clouds, and as such creating even greater condensation. Now, when the rain falls, as you know, it comes back again into the oceans, rivers, lakes. It falls also on the soil, on the earth, and it's absorbed by plants. Some or part of that water seeps or penetrates into the earth, which is sometimes responsible for its emergence again in the form of springs or being conducted through channels back to the oceans. Now, without this delicate balance, as indicated earlier, you could not really sustain life on Earth. So this is a constant process of cycling, if you will, of water.
Can you give us some idea when this water cycle, this concept of the water cycle, was discovered, and what explanations were offered before the discovery of the nature of the water cycle?
Right. Well, this is an area where some specialists, especially in the area of so-called hydrology and hydrogeology, can give us some indication. Some of those scientists have been quoted by Bouquet in his book, The Bible, Quran, and Science, that we quoted before. And they say that the first clear formulation of or about the water cycle goes back to about 1580. 1580. So you're talking about the later part of the 16th century, mostly connected with the name of Bernard Palissy, P-A-L-I-S-S-Y, who indicated that the rainwater does, in fact, infiltrate the soil, a matter that has been confirmed more widely as late even as the 17th century. Before that, there were all kind of strange myths about water cycle. Plato, for example, believed that the water returns back to ocean, that's the rainwater, returned back to the oceans through a great abyss, big, you know, tunnels or holes that connect to the oceans. And that theory seemed to have had supporters as late as the 18th century, that is nearly 1100 years after the revelation of the Quran and the correction of those wrong notions. Some people even used to believe that the water under the that's the water in the oceans under the influence or effect of winds are thrust towards the interior of the continents. About the springs, for example, in the Middle Ages, it was believed that the spring water actually comes from underground lakes, without explaining where these lakes even or where that water stored came from, as if it's been there, for example, since the creation of Earth. You simply say that this is the source of it. And some even believe that the water is coming to these lakes, underground lakes, through holes, which is connecting to the bottoms or the bottom of the oceans. And of course, as it has been made clear now, that these notions, which were very common, not only during the time of the revelation of the Quran, but for hundreds of years after the Quran, are all mistaken, and there is no trace whatsoever in the Quran of any of those mistaken notions. On the contrary, we find that the Quran corrects those mistakes even.
That's interesting. Could you tell us what the Quran has to say with respect to that?
Well, let's take two examples on that from the Quran. Two fascinating citations, if you again think of the time frame when they were revealed in the 7th century. In Surah 39, that's in verse or passage 21, أَلَمْ تَرَ أَنَّ اللَّهَ أَنزَلَ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً فَسَلَكَهُ يَنَبِيعَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. Has you not seen that Allah sent water down from the sky and led it through sources into the ground? Notice this, sources into the ground. Then he caused sown fields of different colors to grow. Notice here, no trace whatsoever of any notion of, let's say, underground lakes that existed there for a long time and did not originate from the rain. It corrected, and it's something that was discovered much later, that it is the rainwater actually that is stored in the or infiltrates into the soil. Another equally interesting passage in the Quran in 23:18-19. وَنَزَّلْنَا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً بِقَدَرٍ فَأَسْكَنَّاهُ فِي الْأَرْضِ. It says that we, that's Allah or God, capital G, we send down water from the sky in measure. And notice this. And we lodged it, lodging that water in the ground. See? Again, showing clearly the correct notion or the correct discovery that actually the water is stored because of the rain that has been penetrated the earth.
Yes.
One more reference I will just make quickly. In Surah 15, for example, in 22, basically it says that Allah sent down the water from the skies, وَمَا أَنْتُمْ لَهُ بِخَازِنِينَ, that you are not guarding or taking care of storing it or hoarding it, which could be also a reference that you cannot prevent it from evaporating and coming back into, you know, the sky in the form of clouds and continuing the cycle. At least one of the meaning could clearly imply that.
Well, you mentioned earlier the role of the clouds and wind in the water cycle. Does the Quran make any reference to that?
Well, let's take one interesting passage in the Quran that touches directly on this issue of clouds and rain. ألم ترى أن الله يسجي سحابا ثم يؤلف بينه ثم يجعله ركاما. The translation of the full passage, which is in 24:43, it says, see you not that Allah makes the clouds, notice the word, move gently, then joins them together, then makes them into a heap, then will you see rain issue forth from their midst, and he sent down from the sky mountain, notice the term, mountain masses of cloud or clouds wherein is hail. This is a very meticulous description if we really stop at some of the wordings.
Yes.
First of all, it talks about the notion of the wind moving those clouds gently together. That's one. Secondly, the term used in the Quran, yuzji, or yu'allif, that is when the clouds are put together, are joined together, which we mentioned again that the scientists speak here about the process of condensation or greater condensation by clouds joining with each other. But another very interesting term here that's used, mountain, using the term of the term mountain in reference to the clouds. I was reading about that while traveling or flying, and I looked from the window and I beheld the view. Anyone looking from the earth here up to the clouds perhaps you can't see much, except that there are some batches here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only when you're flying and looking from the window, especially after the aircraft gets into the cruising altitude just beyond the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Yes.
The description of mountain.
Indeed,
yes. You see, you must have experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
Very clear. Just like range of mountains with various heights, exactly the shape like mountains, just colored differently. You can't distinguish the clouds from the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, somebody says, so what? Anyone can see that. Yes, yeah. Anyone can see that now.
Yeah.
Not in the 7th century.
Yeah.
Nobody in the 7th century was able to. There was no plane to go up and give this very delicate description of the shape of the cloud. And then the ayah also, that passage, speaks also about the, or refers to electricity in the air, because it talks also about the lightning. And this is something, again, that was not known until reasonably recently, that there is electricity in the atmosphere, which has something to do actually with the rainfall. Let me take another ayah, if we have time for it, which is even more amazing. An expression in the Quran, وَأَرْسَلْنَا الرِّيَاحَ لَوَاقِحَ, that is, we sent forth the winds that impregnate. Notice the term impregnate.
Mm-hmm.
And we cause the waters to descend from the sky. That's found, for example, in 15:22. This could have two meanings, depending on what scientist or what kind of orientation the individual is thinking about. The word lawaqih in Arabic, which is translated impregnating, could be a reference, in fact, to the wind and its role in moving the pollen, you know, the powder, small, very light powder that causes the fertilization or the cross-fertilization of plants from the male plant to the female plant. This we can come back to when we deal with the vegetation kingdom and the various miracles again in the Quran about its creation. But the other clear meaning also of it, since it talks about winds and rain, so the obvious reference here seemed to be to the role of wind impregnating. Now we can perhaps inquire, in what sense does the wind impregnate and as such cause rain? I mean, there's no pollens there, there's no male and female cloud. But if you really think about it in terms of the condensation process that you talked about before, that sometimes you may have clouds, but these clouds may not necessarily be rain-carrying clouds. See, and it is only when the wind squeezes or compacts them or moves these clouds together, where you have heavier or more condensation, than you get the rain issuing forth. So it's almost just like the same role of pollinization or impregnation of the wind. And again, this is something that wasn't definitely known at the time of the revelation of the Quran to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. In addition to this, I just picked two major citations in the Quran about this whole notion of the water cycle and the relationship between the clouds and rain. But for those who wish to check further, I'll just give a few references. In the Quran, for example, 7:57, in 25:5, 25:48, and 49, and in 30:48 are some interesting references also to that particular phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how about the so-called artificial rain? Is that a change in the natural process?
Not really a total change in the natural process, as Bouquet say in his book, that the experts in meteorology or meteorologists indicate that it is unlikely that the human can actually produce rain or cause rain to fall from clouds which does not have the suitable characteristics of rain clouds. In other words, which is not, to use a simpler term, which is not mature enough. You can't just produce rain from, you know, nowhere, from any cloud. In other words, you cannot hasten the precipitation process unless the natural conditions are present. And if it were true, that the so-called artificial rain is a technique that you can use to produce rain at well. You could possibly avoid any kind of drought.
See, that eliminates Sahara Desert.
Exactly, it's Sahara Desert, and we find that droughts even exist in even in the most advanced country that could use this technique. So it's not really producing rain as such. Yeah. Something has to be there first to be available before it falls.
Another very interesting area or aspect of this whole examination of the water cycle is the relationship between salt and fresh water.
Mm.
Why don't they mix over time and become medium salt, for example? Is there any explanation for that, the combination of the two? What keeps them distinct?
Well, if they had already mixed like that over thousands or millions of years, life on Earth could have been destroyed, because probably you would not have any
fresh water.
Exactly, fresh water. Of course, in the past, people did not have the desalination plants to obtain fresh water. It could have been really very difficult in many respects. You have to wait for rain, really, to drink fresh water. But there's something really interesting about that has been discovered also by modern science. And what science says that the immediate mixing of the salty seawater and the fresh river water does not in fact occur immediately. There's no immediate mixing between these, even though they meet, as you know. This has been seen, for example, in the Tigris, Euphrates, and any other river, and for that matter, which has a very large outflow of water, like the Mississippi River, for example, in the United States. But there's something even that's more fascinating. I was just reading about that this morning. And by the way, you could find that in some of the elementary textbooks in science in Canadian curriculum, for example. That was brought to my attention during my recent visit to South Africa by Dr. Javeri. He's a medical doctor who used to live in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
I was attending a sort of Islamic training, or ITP Islamic training program.
Yes.
And I met him there. And he brought that point to my attention, which is really fascinating. And what scientists say is that the Gulf Stream, which is very wide, wider than any known river, it's as wide as 32 miles, in fact, that the Gulf Stream, which is a warm stream, begins at the equator and starts moving north into the Gulf of Mexico, and then travels along the coast to Newfoundland, and then it moves east across the Atlantic, where it becomes much wider, and then it continues until it reaches the or near the coasts of several European countries like Norway, France, England, and then spreads after all that lengthy trip, and just disappears into the ocean. But the amazing thing about it is this: that during this very, very lengthy trip, which could be in thousands of miles, the water or the Gulf Stream remain distinct, distinct from the rest of the ocean waters. It does not mix. And this is amazing, because actually not only does it keep distinct, as could be seen, for example, from the color, variation of the color at the edge of the stream, but they say that there is a difference of 20 degrees in the temperature of the Gulf Stream and the ocean. So like someone put it, he said, if you're on board a ship sailing just at the edge, on one side of the ship you can pick water, let's say through a bucket from the stream, from the Gulf Stream, which would be 20 degrees warmer. From the other side of the ship you get water which is 20 degrees colder, which is really an amazing thing. As far as the Quran, Quranic references to that, there are two crucial references, one in 25:53 and one in 55:19 and 20. I realize that we don't have much time to quote them in full, but both references in the Quran basically say that Allah created the earth, created the seas, that is the fresh and the salty, and he led them free, that is, let them get in touch or contact each other, even then despite of that contact, it says that there is a certain partition or barrier between them so that they don't transgress. This is a most fascinating and amazing reference made in the Quran to this recently discovered phenomena, that even though there is mixing in a way between salt and fresh water, it is not really that immediate, it's not that complete, or else, you know, the life on Earth could have not been sustained. The gravitational force could also be regarded as a sort of barrier mm-hmm. that prevents the full mixing and assimilation of water. And the question again, how could Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, know of all of these recently discovered things included in the Quran if it was not known in any previous scripture or even the state of science and knowledge in his time, even for hundreds of years after the revelation of the Quran?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, brother. We'll have to stop at that point. A very interesting program. We want to thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.